Back time to rock and roll. The seventh program in the series, If I Had a Talking Picture, Kenneth Moore follows the development of popular music in Britain and the United States. As the jazz age of the 20s reached its hysterical climax with the all-singing, all-talking motion picture, Al Jolson rose to international fame and Noel Coward sang his obituary for the Empire Builders, Mad Dogs and Englishmen.
Looking back at 1927 from our vantage point, everything in the entertainment business looks a bit quaint, and so do events in the world at large. That aeroplane that Charles Lindbergh flew the Atlantic with, did it ever really leave the ground? Those flagpoles that publicity-hungry young men squatted on the top of, did they really make a living out of it? And was that really living? Were those decorous hemlines really considered fast? And what about the music? But now there's the funny thing. The songs don't sound quaint, at least not the best of them. What does sound a bit ancient to our sophisticated ears is the mechanical aspect of the thing, the antiquated ways of making a record, the dominance still of the theatre as the only place to hear a new song. But the songs themselves, many of them, have shown a quite amazing durability. In fact, you could say 1927 was part of a golden age for popular music. Although, of course, the average man never noticed anything unusually good. He hardly ever does when it comes to music. But if 1927 was a great age, what music best represents it? Well, how about this? Old Man River, sung by a college quarterback who went on to play Othello, Paul Robeson. The song comes, of course, from one of the great shows of the musical theatre, Showboat, and the score written for it was perhaps the most outstanding ever written for a Broadway show up to that time. No surprise, because the man who composed it was Jerome Kern, and every time you mention that name to an established songwriter, the reaction is always the same. And not just songwriters, but whole teams of songwriters. For instance, the testimony of Schwartz and Dietz. Arthur Schwartz wrote the music and Howard Dietz provided the words to some of the greatest songs of their generation. Both revered Kern. Arthur Schwartz for his music and Dietz apparently for his taste in horseflesh and old books.
Well, I think that Kern had the real influence on all the people who followed him. In fact, when Gershwin first wrote, he said that his first songs were exactly like Kern's, and Rogers said the same thing, and we all say the same thing. If there had been no Kern, maybe other composers would have developed. Maybe we, the very ones who did develop, would have done so, but perhaps not in the same way. We were all influenced by Kern.
There's a perfectionist in his craft and very respectful to anybody who can't pursue him musically. When I first saw him, he was studying the Rare Book Catalog. A few years later, I met him in California, and he was reading the racing catalog. He sold his collection of rare books for $1,800,000. He had an amazing library.
Oh, listen, sister, I love my Mr. Man, and I can't tell you why. There ain't no reason why I should love that man. Must be something that the angels done planned. He's got a dream, bird's got a fly. I gotta love what man till I die. Can't help loving that man of mine. Tell me he's lazy, tell me he's slow. Tell me I'm crazy, or maybe I know. Can't help loving that man of mine. When he goes away, that's a rainy day. But when he comes back, the day is bright. The sun on mine, he can come home and make it to be. Oh, without him, ain't no one to me. Can't help loving that man of mine.
Can't help loving that man. One of several outstanding melodies written by Jerome Kern for Schobert. Today, we know that it was one of the biggest money makers in the history of musical theatre, but that's being wise after the event. Flo Ziegfeld, who put the money up, had cold feet so bad that for a year after the show was ready, he delayed the opening. But even odder is a song in Showboat that so many people remember. It had just about the most checkered career of any really famous song. In fact, for years and years, nobody wanted to know anything about it, as J. Fred Coots quite rightly insists.
The song's called He's Just My Bill, and that was composed in 1918 in Oh Lady Lady. Let's be honest, it didn't do anything. Maybe the person who sang it wasn't right. But it was a flop. But then in Showboat in 1927, it was revived, and, you know, it is now one of the great stands.
I used to dream that I would discover the perfect lover. Someday I knew I'd recognize him if ever he came round my way. I always used to fancy then he'd be one of the godlike kind of men, with a giant brain and a noble head, like the heroes bold in the books I've read. But along came Bill, who's not the type at all. You meet him on the street and never notice him. His form and taste, his manly grace, is not the kind that you would find in a statue. Oh, I can't explain, it's surely not his brain that makes me thrill. I love him because he's, I don't know, because he's just my Bill.
But in a way, the oddest fact of all about that song, sung there by the lady who first introduced it, the great Helen Morgan, is that it was part British. The lyric writer was none other than P.G. Wodehouse, who paints a very vivid impression of his old partner.
I don't think he ever did sleep. I was having dinner with Kern once at his house, and we sat talking till about 1 a.m. And then I happened to mention that I'd taken a house down on Long Island, Belport. And he said, oh, let's go and have a look at this. I said, well, not now. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. He insists on going in. We drove all night. And coming back, ghastly, because he kept going to sleep at the wheel. But he was like that. He was very impulsive. In those days, he changed very much. You know, after Showboat, he became rather the music master. You know, the sort of fellow who takes it very seriously. But in those days, he was very good company, very amusing and jolly. I think he felt that he was, you know, above what he'd been doing up to that time.
Edith Day, in another musical moment from Showboat, this time the London production. That show had a pretty daring theme for the musical theatre 50 years ago, dealing as it did, if only at the very edges, with the theme of racial discrimination. The music, too, was adult, in the sense that its tunes were sophisticated. How come that this sort of thing was so commercially viable? Now, Kern was a bit of an old fox on this subject. When a younger writer once asked his advice about the degree to which a man ought to try pleasing the customers, Kern replied, "Go on being uncommercial, there's a lot of money in it." At least partly true, and the lyricist E.Y. Harburg explains why.
It was after the war, America had found its leadership in world events. We were becoming affluent during the 20s, and everybody was wearing silk shirts, and everybody could afford the theater. Not everybody, I say, it was a partial paradise for a segment of America. A great new middle class sprung up, and the liberty of having money for the first time. And they supported the theater, and then, of course, the American business expansion, where buyers had to be wooed, and sellers had to pay for that wooing, and there was a lot of money that they called expense accounts, you know, that they doctored up, and everybody went to the theater.
That song came from another Broadway smash of the period called Good News, all about American college kids. But the Viennese palpitations were still pulling them in at the box office, and sometimes with the cooperation of some very surprising customers. First, let Irving Caesar make his point about the composer of the great hit of 1927, The New Moon.
Rundberg was a great craftsman. Rundberg was not an inspired person. Rundberg knew what he was doing. I won't say he was a plagiarist. Rundberg was a very knowledgeable person and wrote some great tunes, or somehow or other got them. You know, poor Rami. The critics treated him with some consideration at times, but sometimes they would say things like, and the music is by Sigmund Rundberg, who knows a good tune when he hears one. Or another critic would say, and the audience sang the music on the way in. And another fellow trying to be very funny, I don't know whether this was printed or this was a friend of ours who said this, says, when you go to see, and Rundberg was great, honestly, in his way, more commercial, you know, than Kern and all those boys were at times. You know, more commercial songs. Fellow says, when you go to see a Rundberg operetta, put on your smoking jacket, put on your house slippers, fill the old pipe with your favorite tobacco, lean back, and prepare to spend the night with the old masters.
Well, them certainly fighting words. What did Irving Caesar mean by that remark about Rundberg and the old masters? Perhaps he was thinking of this. It was written by Tchaikovsky, and it's called June Barcarolle, which may or may not be a reference to one of Tchaikovsky's girlfriends. From Tchaikovsky, straight into the great Rundberg hit from The New Moon, Lover, Come Back to Me. Lover, Come Back to Me by Rundberg and Tchaikovsky from the operetta The New Moon. Light relief of that kind suggests that Yip Harburg's claim that the musical theatre was growing up may not altogether be accurate. Certainly the most powerful selling point was good old-fashioned optimism. Happy days were always here again, and in the message of Vincent Yeomans, everyone could look forward to a great day.
Lord have us that by and by there's gonna be a great day. Gabriel will warn you some early morn. You will hear his horn. Rudy Dooden is not far away. Hold up your hands and say, there's gonna be a great day.
Great Day, played by the Paul Whiteman Orchestra. And if there's a voice there you think you may recognize, well, you'll have to wait until the end of the program. But we haven't paid much attention so far to what was going on in British popular music. To be frank, by now, it was the American product which dominated. But there was one exception. It so happened that the greatest comic versifier since W.S. Gilbert was in action, and only the fact that he was also at least 20 other things, all of them quite brilliant, made some people overlook the fact. The band leader, songwriter Ray Noble, provides a very uncharacteristic glimpse of Noel Coward, indeed.
I did a date with Noel. It was a couple of numbers from his show. Now, one of them, I think it was Mad Dogs and Englishmen, but I'm not sure. He came to the studio to do it. And in the music copy that I had, I noticed there was a false relation in the harmony. I won't bother anybody with what that means, but every musician knows what a false relation is. It was a false relation. Only in one, I think, one measure, or just even one beat, possibly, I had made the necessary change. Just one quick chord in there, which is gone for him. So we ran the thing through, and Noel said, there's just one error there. So I thought, well, let's see if you can find it, you know. So I said, you point it out to me. He found it. And I said, you would like it back to the original? He said, yes, please. So, all right. So I restored it to the original. I said, you know you're wrong. He said, I don't care whether I'm wrong. That's the way I'm used to it.
In tropical climes for a certain time of day, when all the citizens retire to take their clothes off and perspire, it's one of those rules the greatest fools obey. Because the sun is far too sultry and one must avoid its ultraviolet ray. The natives grieve when the white men leave their huts, because they're obviously, definitely nuts. Mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. The Japanese don't care to, the Chinese wouldn't dare to. Hindus and Argentines sleep firmly from 12 to 1. But Englishmen detest us, yes sir. In the Philippines they have lovely screens to protect you from the glare. In the Malay states there are hats like plates which the Britishers won't wear. At 12 noon the natives swoon and no further work is done. But mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. Such a surprise the eastern eyes to see, that though the English are effete, they're quite impervious to heat. When the white man rides, every native hides in glee, because the simple creatures hope he will impale his solar topi on the tree. It seems such a shame when the English claim the earth, that they give rise to such hilarity and mirth. Mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. The toughest Burmese bandit can never understand it. In Rangoon, the heat of noon is just what the natives shun. They put the Scotch or rye down and lie down. In a jungle town where the sun beats down to the rage of man and beast, English garb of the English Saab merely gets a bit more creep. In Bangkok, at 12 o'clock, they foam at the mouth and run. But mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. Mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. The smallest Malay rabbit deplores its foolish habit. In Hong Kong, they strike a gong and fire off a noonday gun to reprimand each inmate who's in late. In the mangrove swamps where the python romps, there is peace from 12 to 2. Even caribous lie around and snooze, there's nothing else to do. In Bengal, to move at all is seldom, if ever, done. But mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday, 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 sun.
Noel Coward, singing one of his own songs, perhaps the most outstanding social comment song of the entire modern era. In the meantime, America was about to go out into the midday sun of a very different sort of world from the one Noel Coward had in mind. For most of the 20th century, the moving picture industry out in Hollywood had been making do and making dollars out of stories in dumb play. The actors gesticulated and quivered their eyebrows to denote passion, and every so often a few words were flashed up on the screen to explain to the producer what was supposed to be happening. And then, in 1927, this happened.
Mammy, Mammy, the sunshine be, the sunshine well, but I know well that the sunshine's best. Mammy, Mammy, my heart's ring, I hang on around. Alabama, I'm a-comin'. Sorry, I made you wait. I'm a-comin'. I hope and trust that I'm not late. Mammy, I'm talking about my mammy. I'd walk up a million miles for one of your smiles, my mammy. Oh, oh, oh. Mammy. My love, mammy. The sunshine's east and the sunshine's west, but I know where the sunshine's best. It's on my mammy I'm talking about. Nobody else's. My little mammy, my heart dreams, but I hang on around. Alabama. Mammy, mammy, I'm coming. Oh, I hope I didn't make you wait. Mammy, I'm coming. Oh, God, I hope I'm not late. Mammy. Oh, don't you know me? It's a little baby. I'd walk a million miles for one of your smiles. My me.
Well, when Al Jolson sang that song in a movie called The Jazz Singer, he turned a complete industry on its head. Nobody in Hollywood had taken the possibility of talking pictures seriously. Nobody was ready for it, least of all the great movie stars, many of whom had speaking voices like Mickey Mouse. But from the moment Jolson got down on his knees with the boot polish on his face, silent pictures were doomed. And that meant suddenly that popular music was needed as never before. Every studio in Hollywood suddenly started courting the great songwriting teams. And once they did get the songwriters into Hollywood, how did they set them to work? After all, it must have been a very peculiar business, arranging for the mass production of something that isn't really suited to any regulated system at all. Well, conditions appear to have varied from studio to studio, the one common denominator being the chaos that was common to all. There was Leo Robin, for instance, who explains the system that helped him to compose award-winning hit songs.
We managed to pass the time some way. We didn't work. There was nothing to do. Maybe go out and play golf or something like that. Afternoon, we'd show up. You had the report every day. But as long as you reported, it didn't matter whether you stayed there, because I had the producers convinced that I could work better at home, or that I couldn't come in early in the morning because I worked late at night and slept late in the morning. They didn't mind as long as you came in with the song.
It sounds like a pleasant enough sort of life, except that when you did start work, the studio sometimes asked you to perform some pretty impossible feats.
In the early days of musical pictures, there was a period when you had to write what they called the theme song of the picture. If the picture was called Blue Skies, you had to write a song called Blue Skies. If the girl in the picture was named Minnie, you had to write a song called Minnie.
The mind boggles. Until you remember that one of the hits of the old days was something called Minnie the Moocher. Even more ridiculous than Minnie was the song Al Jolson sang in the first all-talking picture, The Singing Fool. Because, you see, The Jazz Singer had been a silent movie with a sound sequence inserted. This time, Jolson started singing and never stopped. The result was one of the most parodied songs of all time, The singer, Arthur Tracy, does what he can to make excuses for Jolson.
Jolson was a great performer, but he had had, in his youth, had had so much opposition from his parents and people in the profession and a brother. And people are so prone to say, you'll never make it. But then when you do, they all claim credit for, I told you so, you know, the old business. And then when he signed a contract finally, a long-term contract, I think it was 10 years, with the Schuberts, and they tried to drink his blood. In fact, they did, like most producers and agents love to drink actors' blood. I don't know why, but they do. And they took so much advantage of him, he could never get what he wanted until his box office draw became so tremendous that he began to be able to dictate. And then, of course, he was asking 60% of the show, but he got 50, started with 25 and went up and made his demands, and they had to give it to him because they made more money with the lesser income on their part from his shows than they did from a greater part with other shows. You know what I mean? But I do know this for a fact, that when his contract was eventually up, and Ziegfeld was making him offers, and there were so many producers making him offers, he went out again, one of his antics. His contract was finished, he went out on Broadway, just pranced around, danced around on Broadway, thank God I'm a free man, I'm free, because people wanted to know what it was all about, and it was explained. But, you know, there's always a reason for whatever a person does or whatever a person is.
Climb up on my knee, honey boy. Though you're only three, honey boy. You've no way of knowing, there's no way of showing what you mean to me. Honey boy, when there are gray skies, I don't mind the gray skies. You make them blue, honey boy. Friends may forsake me. Let them all forsake me. I still have you, honey boy. You came from heaven, and I know your worth. You've made a heaven for me right here on earth. When I'm old and gray, promise you won't stray, dear, from your dear old dad, Sonny Boy. When there are gray skies, I don't mind the gray skies. You make them blue, Sonny Boy. Friends may forsake me. Let them all forsake me. I still have you, Johnny boy. You came from heaven, and I know your worth. You made a heaven for me right here on earth. And the angels, they grew lonely, took you because they were lonely. Now I'm lonely too. So
Jolson, jerking the tears out of cinema audiences with Sonny Boy. The song, by the way, which its composers, the team of Henderson, Brown, and De Silva, are said to have written with their tongues firmly in their cheeks, only for Jolson to take it all seriously. Nobody took it more seriously than the movie industry, which grabbed all the songwriters it could, including Harry Warren.
We'd meet at the studio every day, and we'd work a few hours or something like that. Maybe go back at night. I always liked to work at night, and the studio was great, nice and quiet. And I did that at Fox for many years. But I think you can work any place. Doesn't make any difference. The only difference is, I think, is that it's easier to dirty up an office in a studio than do it in your own house.
Nevertheless, Harry Warren finished up with 4 Oscars on the mantelpiece. But the theater did go on, even though many of its best composing talents were going west to the fleshpots of Hollywood. For instance, the Gershwin brothers, George and Ira, were destined not to join the moving picture colony for several years yet, and in 1927, America was humming to itself one of the best ballads the two brothers ever wrote. It was originally meant by George to be a fast tap-dancing routine, but Ira suggested halving the tempo and making it a love song, and a love song it's been ever since. Gertrude Lawrence, singing Someone to Watch Over Me, from the Gershwin musical O.K., a great song. But at that time, everybody was writing them. If we take a look at the giants of the popular song of the period, we can see that none of them are short of ideas. One song that had pretensions to social comment of a kind was a song written by Walter Donaldson, which Eddie Cantor made so famous that it's remembered to this day. Perhaps because one of the problems it deals with is still with us, the battle of the sexes.
Every time I hear that dear old wedding march, I feel rather glad I have a broken arch. I have heard a lot of married people talk, and I know that marriage is a long, long walk. To most people, weddings mean romance, but I prefer a picnic or a dance. Another bride, another groom, another sunny honeymoon, another season, another reason for making whoopee. The choir sings, here comes the bride, another victim is by her side. He's lost his reason, 'cause it's the season for making whoopee. Down through the countless ages, you'll find it everywhere. Somebody makes good wages, somebody wants her share. She calls him Toodles and rolls her eyes. She makes him strudels and bakes him pies. What is it all for? It's so he'll fall for making whoopee. Another year, or maybe less. What's this I hear? Well, can't you guess? She feels neglected, and he's suspected of making whoopee. She sits alone most every night. He doesn't phone or even write. He says he's busy, but she says, is he? Is me? He doesn't make much money. $5,000 per. Some judge who thinks he's funny says you pay $6 to her. He says, now judge, suppose I fail. The judge says, but right into jail. You'd better keep her. You'll find it's cheaper than you.
Eddie Cantor, Making Whoopee. By the time he wrote that song, Walter Donaldson was one of the giants of popular music. But in the same year, 1927, a much younger, quite unknown young man called Johnny Green had a success just as big.
Yes, the summer of 1927, which was the summer holiday between my junior and senior years at Harvard. That's when I went to Cleveland to work as an arranger for the Lombardo Band. And while there, Carmen and I wrote Coquette, and Gus Kahn was a great friend of theirs. And it was due to that that Gus wrote the lyric. Then Gus and I became very close friends. And we wrote a great many songs together, but none of them ever hit. Coquette, of course, was a smash.
Tell me why you keep fooling little Coquette, making fun of the ones who love you, breaking hearts you are ruling, little Coquette. True hearts tenderly dreaming of you. Someday you'll fall in love as I fell in love with you. Maybe someone you love will just be fooling. And when you're all alone with only regret, you'll know, little Coquette, I love you.